Hi everyone. Welcome to All Things Creative. I'm your host, Linda Riesenberg-Fissler, and I'm here with Joe McGurl. And we're going to talk about a number of different things. But first, I want to say hi to Joe and welcome to the show.
Hi, Linda. How are you?
Oh, doing well. Getting ready for that major snowstorm that's coming our way.
and hello to all you listeners out there.
Yeah, hopefully, the weather will get better by the time we air this thing, but it's been actually pretty crazy. So actually wanted to have you on the show to talk about site size for one thing, which is kind of this nice contraption that you have next to your easel, which I'm assuming helps you size everything correctly to the size of canvas that you're working on. Is that correct? Tell us a little bit about the method.
Okay. It was developed over about 500 years during the from the Renaissance up until like the end of the 19th century. They kept sort of improving the method. It's called site size drawing.
Okay.
And it reached its zenith in the French Academy. And there, virtually every artist who was training to be a fine artist would learn the site size method. And then when modernism came along, it was discarded and it was almost forgotten. There was an artist in Boston, Ives Gamel, and he learned from William Paxton, who learned from Jerome how to do the site size method. So he preserved the knowledge.
Hmm.
And there are several artists who went through his program in Boston, centered at the Guild of Boston Artists, and learned the site size method. And that's where I learned it from Robert Cormier, who was a student of Ives Gamel. So in a nutshell, what you do is you set up your subject right next to your easel. So they're side by side, if you were doing a portrait or a still life. And then you walk back several feet and you find how far back you want to stand from the subject in the painting. And that's your viewing spot. And you look at the canvas and at the subject and you flick your eye back and forth between the two. And then you go up and you make a mark, maybe where the top of the head is. Then you walk back to your viewing spot. You may put a piece of tape on the floor or something, so you're in that same spot every time.
Mm-hmm.
And you look and you decide whether that little mark with the top of the head is too high or too low. And if you get the height right, then you check the width side to side. How far is it from the edge of the canvas? And then you go back again and you put a little dot where the chin might be.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you're a student, you can use a level and make sure that the dot that you line up the chin with is the exact same height as the actual chin of the subject. And if it is, then you go ahead and you may have calipers even, and you can say, okay, how wide is the head, like from ear to ear? And you measure that on the subject, and then you bring the calipers over to the painting or the canvas, and you put two little marks where that is. So it's all pretty much measurement. And so you have all these little points where key marks for the figure or the still life are, and you start connecting the lines and you start refining it. But the idea is that when you look at something the same size, it's much easier to see mistakes in drawing and such because you're just flicking your eye back and forth between the subject to the canvas, subject to the canvas. You do that several times and the corrections become really obvious that you've got to make. So it's a really good way to learn how to draw the figure or something really complex. And so I learned it from Bob Cormier. I spent 2 years studying figure drawing with him. It was just with charcoal and paper.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a real eye-opener. It really turned my art around because I'd gone to Mass College of Art, and they really weren't into representational art. We were sort of the quaint realists over in the corner. And I never really had a good figure drawing class, and I was always struggling with the figure and with drawing and such too. And I was also sort of under the influence of what they were teaching, which is painting broadly with big expressive brush strokes, and my landscapes weren't very good, and I actually wasn't very happy with the way they looked. I just didn't like my paint. And then one day I said, I'm just not going to do this anymore. I'm going to paint the way I want to paint. But I was having a hard time because I didn't have the skills.
Right.
And then through an artist friend of mine, Frank Spazuller, I learned about Bob Cormier and the Guild of Boston Artists and how they were teaching site-sized figure drawing. So I went to Bob and I asked if I could sign up for his class, and I did, and it was just really transformative. The idea that you could slow down and be really, really careful with your drawing, getting everything exact,
right,
not expressive, because at this stage I didn't have the skills to be expressive. I couldn't draw well enough. So what I wanted to do was to be able to draw well enough so then I could move on and do whatever I wanted, but I didn't have the skills to do it at that time. So I learned the method, and it was totally transformative, because just the idea that you can look very carefully, and art can be very slow and deliberate, as opposed to sort of fast and emotional, which they were sort of pushing at Mass College of Art. And so I love the method, and I've been working since I stopped painting with stopped studying with Bob Cormier. I've gone into landscape painting, which is my real love.
Mm-hmm.
And I painted for like several years, and one day I thought, well, I wonder if there's a way to adapt the site size method to landscape painting. Well, there isn't in a way, because you can't put your canvas next to a cloud or next to a mountain, you know, 20 miles away, and then you've got something in the foreground, you know, with a tree that's 30 feet away. So how do you put your canvas next to that? You really can't do it.
Right.
But then I thought I could do sort of a comparative drawing exercise, where you have everything the same proportion, but it's not necessarily the same size in real life that it would be. So it's a little bit hard to do it without the frame. So I thought, what if I make a frame that's the same size as my panel? Then everything I see within that square of the frame, I transfer horizontally or vertically onto my panel. And that way, all the proportions will be exactly the same.
Hmm.
So I started fooling around with that, and I came up with this design that that does that. I clamp it to the side of my canvas, and I look through it, and I stand in the same spot. I don't usually walk back and forth. Usually I'm sort of arm's length away,
mm-hmm,
or so. And I can adjust how much of the scene I see by moving back and forth. If I move closer to the viewfinder frame, I can see I have a bigger view. If I stand back further, it's a more compressed view. So I can adjust my composition in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I do is everything I see through my viewfinder frame, I transfer horizontally or vertically. It can go either the side or at the top of your canvas onto my canvas.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing about it is for a plein air painter in particular, it makes things go much, much faster, because you're not fooling around with the drawing. It's much easier to draw quickly and accurately with it. And where time is of the essence, you know, the sun is moving, the clouds are coming in, the wind is coming up, you're painting a moving subject. The faster that you can paint it, the better it will come out, because you're not trying to erase the light. It's, you're painting a little bit more quickly and more efficiently. And then you can also make adjustments and changes. I often change, you know, a lot of things in my plein air paintings. But at least if I have the drawing down pretty accurately, the changes are deliberate and they're conscious. And I know, okay, this tree doesn't look good in this spot, so I'm going to move it a little bit, or I'm going to change the shape of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll change the color. I can make changes. So it doesn't lock you into anything, but it helps you to become more expressive, because you have time to make those changes. And they're thoughtful changes rather than just sloppy drawing change. The other interesting thing that I've discovered about it is when I look at something, and I notice this happens to a lot of other artists too, when you look at something, it appears bigger. And when you start doing that, things have a hard time fitting onto your canvas.
Mm-hmm.
But with the site size viewfinder, you're measuring things, so you don't have that problem. Like if you're painting a building in the distance, our mind automatically makes that bigger. And so if you make it bigger in your painting, then suddenly all the other elements aren't going to fit into the space that you have available. So the viewfinder really helps with that. And it's amazing how big the foreground is. When you put a viewfinder out and you look through it and it's the same size as your panel,
uh-huh,
we have a really big foreground. And there again, it's because our eyes often focus on the midground or the background. They appear bigger to us, and so we tend to skimp on the foreground, and that kind of boosts up the perspective and the receiving space, aspect of a landscape painting. So it really helps with composition and also getting your drawing pretty much locked in a very quick and efficient manner. And it's also good for portrait and still life painting too, because it helps you paint much more accurately and much quicker. So it works for, you know, indoors and outdoor painting too.
So
and that's kind of it in a nutshell. How?
Yeah, and
how
I know.
On my website, there's a page that has diagrams and such, and it shows how it works and how you hook it up and such. One of the things that's important is it takes a little while to get the discipline down to getting back into your looking spot every time when you make corrections of the drawing. Mm-hmm. So you've got to use it maybe, you know, 6 or 7 times before it becomes second nature that you always just get back into that spot, get your marks lined up, and then you make corrections to the drawing. Some people get sloppy and they don't get back into that same spot.
Right. So hang with me a minute. I'm going to go and move to another painting here. So here's your plein air painting. I think this is the one in Colorado, right? With the gold aspens.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. We'll let folks look at that. But when it's very hard, I know, to talk sight size on an audio or even a video like this. It's probably makes a lot more sense if we're standing there in a workshop with you and you're covering this. But I'm just curious, does like rule of thirds still apply with the viewfinder that you have? And I mean, can they work in tandem together, or does it take some of that guesswork of using that away?
I think it frees you a little bit, because you don't always have to sort of do things by the rule. You can do them by what just sort of looks good to you.
Okay.
And sometimes you can, you know, break the rules is always a good thing too. Like the one mm-hmm. of the little golden tree up on the hillside, that kind of breaks the rules for what a landscape should be, because a tree is like smack dab in the middle of the panel.
Right.
And, you know, ordinarily you'd say, well, you know, you should use the golden mean and put it down in the lower right or lower left or upper right or upper left section. Mm-hmm. But I wanted this to be just a study of a tree, and almost like it was a portrait mm-hmm. of a little tree.
Right.
And with the viewfinder, you can hold it up there and decide, does that look good or does it not look good? Because you're basically seeing the finished painting at the same scale that it's going to be painted at. So in a way, it gives you a lot more options and a little bit of freedom to do things a little bit differently. And also, I think people aren't as intimidated because they can try a more challenging composition, because it works faster, you paint faster, and you paint more accurately. So, you know, sometimes you can get into these really complex compositions and they come out fine because you've got all the information there.
Okay. So is your viewfinder just what it was on the first screen, just the outer bars, the frame?
It's just the frame, and there's a string grid that you can string on it optionally if you want to divide it into 9 little sections, and you can draw that same grid on your panel. And then you're just, it's like, you know, in high school when kids, like, they get a magazine and they grid it off and they draw a picture
right.
from the magazine.
Right.
It's kind of the same idea in a way. You grid off your panel, and then you have your scene gridded off with the viewfinder grid, and then you can just compare square to square.
Okay, great. And I noticed that it's obviously bigger than any of the viewfinders I think that I have in my possession at this point.
Right.
And it really is just looking at that scene that you want to paint, I think.
Yes, and it's important that it's the same scale as your painting, as your panel.
Okay.
And the viewfinders that, you know, most of people have, they're small, and you're just sort of looking for the view that you want to paint. And this one is you're going to actually be painting the exact same scale that you see in the viewfinder.
That sounds fascinating. I remember when seeing it on Facebook, and I shared it a couple times when you posted it out that you had this new viewfinder available. And it was just, I think did you do a video with this too? Or did you do a video shortly after? Not yet. Okay.
So, well, actually, I did a video with Streamline Publishing. It's called Light, Painting Light and Atmosphere. And I used the viewfinder for the planar section of that.
Okay. Because I remember
I'm
seeing
having
him.
an, yeah,
Go.
that's how I, you can see me using it. I am going to at some point get a video of me doing it to put on my website for the viewfinder.
Yeah,
But I
it's
really
great.
wasn't going to, when I started this, I wasn't going to manufacture them. But when I would be teaching workshops, and I thought, well, it's not fair if I use this viewfinder and I don't show the students. So I showed the students the viewfinder and they wanted to try it. So we got some mat board and we tried making them out of mat board, but it doesn't really work very well with mat board because it would blow in the wind and you
Right.
have to have a little bend in it so you can have the viewfinder and your panel perpendicular when you look at them. So the viewfinder has a little bend in it. And if you, it's hard to explain, but if you look on the viewfinder web page, you can see how it works.
Right.
So I started you know doing that with the students, and it was kind of frustrating because the mat board didn't really work. And then there was one student that her husband made some out of wood that worked pretty well. But then I thought, you know, why don't I make some up out of metal? And my son is an industrial designer, so he was working at a company that they produced a lot of metal products. So I said, could you make this for me? And he helped me tweak it, and we got it built, and we've sold about 800 of them so far.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, they're pretty popular. Every day we get a few orders.
All right. So, say your website and where they can find us so that, because I know they're like, tell me the website and while they're listening to this. So,
yeah, it's my own website, josephmcgurl.com. And when you go onto the website, you'll see a viewfinder page. It says, I think Joseph Girl site size viewfinder.
Okay.
And it has information on how to use it and
cool.
how to order it and such on that page.
Okay. Well, you may end up getting another order for me because I can take it to my class and then they'll
Yeah.
all order it too. So,
Yeah.
and then I'll have to have you come down and teach a workshop. So,
Yeah. It just goes on and on.
I know. Amazing is that how that works, isn't it? So,
Yeah.
okay. So, I think part of the discussion that we're going to have today is a little bit about breaking the rules. And you were just talking about how this one breaks the rules. Never put anything smack dab in the middle, which this painting is gorgeous and it works. So obviously, that rule was broken here. I was probably taught very, I'm sorry, I heard you start to talk. So if there's something you want to say about breaking that rule, go right ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Okay. There was another rule that, and I'm using quotes around the word rule here,
Yeah.
that I was told, and it was probably because I was still learning at the time. But it was like, you never use, you know, just white, you know, I mean, even if you like tinted it just a little bit with color, it was still like too white. One of my teachers
Right.
rules is too white. But yet, when I look at some of your paintings, there's some stuff that's pretty close to white, like that center really hot area in this particular painting that we're looking at now. And there are some other ones that we can use in reference as well, but this just happened to be the next painting of yours.
Yeah.
Obviously, you think it's okay, right?
Yeah, in small amounts. And it depends on, you know, every painting is different. And if you look at like an Andrew Wyeth watercolor, he'll have huge swaths of white if he's doing a snow scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the pure white of the paper. So I think rules are great when you're starting out because it helps keep you somewhat in control. But it also lets you know like what the parameters are and then how you can break those parameters and create something a little bit unique and personal and interesting. I think if you follow the rules all the time, your paintings become sort of not all that interesting because you've seen that composition device so many times before. There's an artist, the early 20th century, Edgar Payne, who was a wonderful Southwest artist.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book, The Composition of Outdoor Painting.
Yep, read
and
it.
He has all these different devices for compositions. And they're wonderful devices for compositions. But now I see like artists who use them over and over again. And it's like, oh, that's the, you know, the Steelyard one, or he has like all these different names for them.
Right.
That's the three spot. And so it becomes kind of a crutch and a device. So I think it's good to learn the rules and, you know, definitely look at Edgar Payne's book, but then try new ways to sort of break those rules and come up with your own little compositional devices. Nature gives you so many opportunities to do that.
Right.
It's always, you know, different shapes and different proportions and such. So, and every now and then, you know, then sometimes you do fall back in the rules. So, well, this really is three spot really works really well here. Mm-hmm. And that's fine.
Yeah.
But it's nice to, you know, explore other things. And there's one painting I did, it's called Singularity. And it's just a big rock and it almost fills the whole canvas. Just a little sliver of sky and water around it. And I really like the composition, but it totally breaks all the rules. It's even more central than that little, the one of the tree.
Right.
Because it's, you know, it's very massive and it's just this sort of big monolithic blob in the middle of the painting.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting because one of the conversations that I have with my students from time to time, because they'll talk to, you know, they'll want to talk about composition a little bit. And I always come back and say, like, they'll come in with reference that they want to paint and all this. And the first question I ask them is, what is it about this that drew your eye? You know, what made this something that you wanted to paint? And it was like, well, you know, it's, mm-hmm. it's maybe this object over here, but that I'm going to move this over so that it sits right in one of those primary. And I'm like, no, wait a minute. we always have this conversation about the compositions and the rule of third and those specific viewing areas. And like you said, it's great when you start out because it helps you hone those skills that you need to learn. And then all of a sudden it's like, we can't break those rules because we have that fear of if we do that, you know, I won't be able to paint it, or it won't be looked at if I put it in a show the same way because it's not part of the same, you know, it doesn't have a strong composition because it doesn't fit Edgar Payne's definitions for composition. I mean, you hear all of those different kind of conversations. And
right.
I think it's kind of interesting that I'm hearing from someone as, you know, master artist Joe here saying, you know, oh, break those rules. It's like, all right, somebody's given me permission, you know?
Yeah. But it's important that you know the rules so you know what you're breaking, sort of. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like if you're a musician, you have to learn scales and such before you can experiment and go beyond that. But it's good to know, you know, sort of the rudimentary aspects of your profession.
Yeah, I mean, we even go to a conversation when we start talking about abstract paintings and painters. And I said, you know, at some point, they still are pulling or thinking of a specific rule or foundation to make that abstract work. They couldn't have, I always say, and you may disagree with me, and if you do, that's great. But I always say that they're somewhere in the back of their mind pulling on the things that they learned before they got into their abstract life, if you want to call it that. So,
yeah.
You know, like I can look at some abstracts and say, okay, this is what they were probably drawing on in a particular foundation or a particular rule. You know, one thing for sure, they play a lot on complement colors, for example.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So it is kind of interesting to see that and hear that. So, but it is kind of, it's also very hard for me to do that painting with white, for example, because it's just like, oh no, somebody told me I wasn't allowed to do that.
Well, when I was in college, they said, you know, never use black.
Oh.
And then for years I was mixing black the hard way with burnt umber and ultramarine blue. And then one day I realized Sargent used black, Monet used black, all these artists use black. So the idea is you can use black as long as you use it intelligently, and the same thing goes for white. I think what they're afraid of is that if you use white to lighten everything and then don't adjust the saturation of the color, mm-hmm. it tends to look pasty.
Right.
And if you use black to darken everything, it tends to look sort of charcoal-y and gray.
Mm-hmm.
But they're great colors to use to modify different colors. And there's a lot of places where I'll use pure black or pure white in my paintings mm-hmm. in small parts, because if you, generally speaking, there again, this is a rule that can obviously be broken. But if you use too much of them, like too much white, you're going to lose a lot of power.
Right.
Or too much black. So I tend to use them in small amounts, but I definitely a lot of my paintings have a little bit of white and a little bit of black in them because I'm trying to exploit the range of value that we have available to us, because a landscape painting doesn't have nearly the range of value that nature has, because we don't have any paint that's as bright as sunlight, and we don't have any paint that's as dark as a dark shadow under a tree or something.
Mm-hmm.
So we're always trying to expand our range, and by using a little bit of white or near white and a little bit of black, it gives me the whole range from, you know, the lightest to the darkest value that I have available.
Yeah, I guess that takes me to a question of, we have millions of colors, but we have a limited range of value. So we always tend to try to choose a color change probably over a value change because of that. Is that
right? They sort of have to work hand in hand.
Yeah.
Because we don't, as I was saying, we don't have the range. There are some artists that they use a limited value range, and they have a philosophy on why that works, and that's fine, but I don't agree with that for my own work, because I'm trying to recreate the sensation I have being out of doors rather than creating sort of a painting that was painted indoors. So in order for me to recreate that sensation, I have to push the values and the colors as strong as I can, but still keep them within sort of the realm of possibility, so I don't get, you know, totally outlandish colors. I want them to look natural, and I'm struggling to get that natural look with, you know, pigment that's no brighter than the white paint you have on your walls, or, you know, the dark paint you have on your furniture.
So you're not one that'll stand there and say, oh, I'm going to limit myself to four values and then try to stay into that. If you see a shift in value, you put it in with the appropriate color. Is that what you're?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And there are beautiful paintings made with, you know, these limited value range paintings,
mm-hmm.
but that's not what I'm about. I'm doing something different. And that's what's great about the art world. Everyone's doing something different.
Right.
And I always say that, you know, it's good that artists disagree, because if we all agreed, it would be pretty monotonous out there.
Right.
So I like it when artists disagree with me and say, well, that's not the way I do it, you know. And I say, well, great, you know, and your paintings look wonderful the way you do it. And I do it differently. It's like everyone's doing sort of their own thing in a way. And so we should all disagree.
Right. And I'm one of the ones that like to limit myself in value. So,
yeah.
And I'm not taking it that we disagree or we arguing or anything like that. I just find it interesting. Because I love your work, and it's, you know, I look at your paintings, and I never really thought about it, because there is this cohesiveness that you've got going on with color and everything that now I'm like going, I'm going to take some of your work and turn it into black and white and see what I see.
Yeah.
So you might get an email from me, Joe. But,
yeah.
No. See, you only did five here.
Well, that's what's great about the art world. There are so many different approaches, and everybody's right. You know, it's it's not like this is the way you do it. It's like this is the way I do it, and you can take little bits. I take little bits from other artists all the time. I say, oh, I like the way you did that.
Right.
And, yeah. You know, I'm obviously influenced by all kinds of other artists and things that I've seen.
Yeah.
Years ago, I saw this interview with Mick Jagger, and the interviewer was trying to get him to say, who was better, the Beatles or the Rolling Stones? And it's funny because Mick wasn't going to fall for it. And he kept saying, well, I think what we do is really good and what they do is really good. And I think that's how it is in the art world too. There's, you know, different styles of painting and different subjects and such and all that. And what one guy does is really good, but someone else is doing something else that's different and that's really good. And you really can't compare the two.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say, I prefer this one, I prefer that one, but you can't say this one is good and that one's bad. They're both, you know, doing something different.
Yeah. And in all honesty, what helped me was limiting the number of values, because it made me expand my color choices, my palette, if you will, and understand, you know, mixing a color to a specific value, which I think helps make a painting strong. But at the same token, you know, I had to learn how to control color. And one way to do that for me was through value. So once, you know, now if I'm painting and I sit there and go, wow, I really want this, you know, to stand out. I want this contrast or whatever. And it's like, you know, I don't sit here and go, well, I have to stay in this value. Now, now I'll say, well, I can mix the color that's, you know, up in this value a little bit and, you know, really make it pop or whatever the, you know, whatever the logic is in your head. So, but I think as it took me so many of those years of only painting, you know, allowing myself to have no more than four values or no more than five values in a painting really did help me understand color more.
Yeah, because you've got to use color to say it rather than value.
Right.
It's like the tonalist painters, like George Ennis, for instance. He was very limited when he really got into tonalism in his mm-hmm. value range.
Mm-hmm.
But then his near contemporary, Frederick Church, had values from, you know, white to black, basically.
Right.
And they were both doing, you know, painting landscapes and doing beautiful work,
mm-hmm.
but they were different. You know, they had different approaches, different philosophies. And for their philosophy, their approach, you know, really worked well. And that's one of the things that's important, too. I think your philosophy kind of has to come first. And then your method sort of follows that rather than some people sort of come up with a method and then sort of try to fit the philosophy or don't really even have a philosophy. But for me, it's, you know, the philosophy comes first and then my method sort of tries to fit that philosophy.
Okay. So tell us about your philosophy then. I mean, we've been talking about it a little bit, but just kind of more, you know, succinct.
Well, this sort of an underlying theme of my artwork, and one of the things that I'm fascinated and intrigued with is what is, and I think everyone is, it's kind of the big question, what's the meaning of life? What are we?
Mm-hmm.
Where are we in the universe? What's the nature of reality? And, you know, since I'm a landscape painter, I've also been interested in physics because physics basically is about the world we live in, things that I'm painting. And so reading physics and also about the reading about the transcendentalists of the 19th century and such, I believe that there's a spiritual existence to the universe and there's a reality out there somehow or other that contains this spirituality. And I'm trying to find out what that is and what it's about. And I know I'll never find the answer to it, but I feel close to the question when I'm painting the landscape and sort of dissecting it and trying to put it back together on my canvas with paint. And I know that when I look at this tiny grain of sand on a beach, that if I knew everything about that grain of sand, I would have the answer. I would know what the, you know, where we came from, where we're going, what is the nature of reality.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that that answer is within my subject. And also the transcendentalists were really influential with the luminist painters. A lot of the luminists were aware of transcendentalism with, you know, Thoreau and Emerson were probably two of the leading transcendentalists.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that you could sort of, nature was a portal to the divine and you could see that in light in particular. They were really convinced that there was some connection between the sublime and light. So a lot of the luminous paintings had a really strong light effect and they were conscious of painting light when they were painting. And so coincidentally, physicists used the photon, which is the particle that lets us see light, as one of their primary vehicles to try to understand the workings of the universe, which I thought was an interesting coincidence.
Yeah.
That the photon is has spiritual significance and also really significant for the world of physics. And so a lot of my paintings have a strong emphasis on light.
Right.
Different lighting scenarios and the effects of sunlight. And they're really paintings of light. And the landscape is the vehicle that I use to explore that.
Yeah.
And so that sort of underlying philosophy leads me to my methods. And, you know, as I was saying, one of the methods, for instance, is using a full range of values because I'm trying to get things to look like they're illuminated with light and get that focus on light. And I also have varying textures in my paintings. It's hard to see when you see them on, like, on a computer screen or reproduce, but in real life, there's quite a bit of texture. And there's a variety of texture. Some parts are very smooth, some parts are very rough, because I'm painting these different elements. And if I'm painting a scene that has sky, land, and water, well, I'm thinking that the sky is nothing but gas and dust and photons streaming through it. So there's no real texture or substance to that. And then if I'm painting, say, a beach, beaches like rocks and gravelly sections or whatever. And so I want to have some texture there. And then if I'm painting the water might have a different texture than the beach. It may be sort of a horizontal striated texture that replicates all the little ripples in the water.
Right.
So, you know, my technique is really the result of the philosophy that I have underlying my paintings.
You have a...
And I don't worry about... Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, you have this great sense of being an adventurer or... I just remember when I took the workshop from you down in Art of the Carolinas, and you were showing us all of the different tools that you use, and it's like, used a turkey baster, you found another like roll of faux, like a faux finish roller or something. You have so many cool tools, you know, and it's just like, well, what's this going to do? And I love that sense of adventure and that the inquisitiveness. And I think that definitely comes from your philosophy as well. So.
Right. And when I was in college, I remember, you know, the teachers would make these pronouncements every now and then. And one of them was that you must maintain the integrity of the brushstroke. And so for a while after college, I was doing that because I thought that's what you should do. And then one day I said, the heck with that. And I started using all kinds of different tools and such to manipulate the paint and apply it to the surface.
And
I have this a baster, which is just kind of a plastic rubber brush with the, like, if you envision a paintbrush, but the bristles are all rubber.
Mm-hmm.
That works really well for doing one type of texture. And I have these rollers that you use for decorative painting that makes a different type of texture. I use squeegees. I put sand in my paintings. I use a lot of acrylic emulsions with like glass beads and molding paste and things like that. So I do a lot with texture in my paintings.
Yeah.
And as I said, I like to have the different elements have different textures because they're so different. For me, for my type of work, it doesn't seem natural that I would paint water in the same way that I would paint a rock.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there's some artists that they love to leave their brush mark there, and so you can see the brush stroke, and that works great for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I really admire, you know, those paintings too.
Yeah, and
as long as it's well done, I love the painting. It's not I'm not like a dogmatic about how paintings should be made.
No, you're not.
Because I'm always surprised, and I see paintings that it's like, oh, that's so cool how he did that.
Yeah,
and a lot of times I'll incorporate that into my work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can vouch for anybody that is looking at Joe's paintings on the computer screen. While he has wonderful light, and by the way, the one that we're looking at right now, it's just like Edgar Payne. I can see Edgar Payne's influence in this one, and I mean that as a really huge compliment, Joe. So, because I like his work as well. But yeah, I mean, I've seen some of Joe's work in person, and it's very textural. They're gorgeous. So if you have a chance to go see Joe's work, please do. Cause you'll be actually very surprised at how much texture there is in there. Cause I think when I was at Art of the Carolinas and I walked in and was looking at some of the work that you had there, I think he even said that to you, was that I didn't expect to see as much texture as I saw, but. So it's gorgeous. Do you want to tell us about this painting in front of us?
So I can't see on my screen which one it is.
Oh, okay. It's
but you can just tell me which one.
It's the ones that looks like you're probably in Monument Valley. It's
okay.
And it has a little warrior down in the bottom.
Yeah, and there's a little runner coming up the path. That's it was called Born to Run. And I painted it for the Quest for the West show, that's the annual art exhibition and sale that we have at the Idle George Museum in Indianapolis, which is a fantastic museum. If anyone's in Indianapolis, they should check out the Idle George Museum. But anyway, you know, that it's a the museum of the American Indian in the West. So the show, you know, focuses on paintings of the West. And I thought, you know, we see all these paintings of Indians in blankets and such after the white man came, but I thought they existed for, you know, a long time before. And what was it like before then? And I'd read this book called Born to Run, which is about the tribe of Indians in northern Mexico who are natural runners, and they run it with these huarache sandals and such. And it was a pretty intriguing book. And so I thought one day, maybe we'll do a painting of the Southwest before, you know, the Europeans came. And so then I thought, well, I got to get some type of motif. And I thought, you know, it'd be similar to northern Mexico, maybe. And so I came up with this composition. I had a painting of a cloud, and I used that cloud in the painting. And so the idea was that there's a runner and he's going maybe from one camp to another, or maybe carrying a message or something. And it's just a very simple painting with not a lot of sort of historical meaning, but I just wanted to explore that subject and that theme and sort of the idea of, you know, before the Europeans, what was it like in America? And it was kind of fun working with the warm colors of the landscape and the cool colors of the clouds. I painted in Arizona a few times and the Southwest, and it's just beautiful landscape down there.
Yeah.
And
I guess I have to, I'm sorry, Joe, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. No, you go.
I was just going to say that I need to remind everybody who's listening that Joe does not use photo reference. He uses his studies. So Joe, that's one thing that Joe will probably never use, right? You just won't use photo reference, right? Because you have all your wonderful studies, naturally. But
yeah, and I don't need them, and they don't do anything for me. I remember in college, everyone was painting from photographs, and I usually didn't. And I remember doing a painting of a boat from a photograph, and I finished it, and it looked like the boat, but it was just so uninspiring. It was like, eh. This is just, it wasn't fun. And ever since I was a kid, I always used to make things up. And like the Born to Run painting is 99% made up. And when I was in high school, I went to the Museum of Fine Arts on Saturdays for art classes. And we had this wonderful teacher, Ralph Rosenthal, who was a big influence on me when I was a kid. And he had this photo file. So like if we were going to draw a painting of, let's say, do a horse, it's like, well, how does the horse's back leg look? So we could go to the photo file, and he would let us look at the horse's back leg. But if he copied it or made it the same pose, he would make us stop and say, you can't copy it. You can use it for reference to see how the horse's leg bends. But I don't want to see that same, you know, leg recreated on your paper. And so he would never let us do that. And he'd come around all the time, and every now and then he'd rip someone's paper in half and said, you copied the, you know, the photo or the drawing in the photo file or the reference file. So that was sort of ingrained in me really young, that you don't really copy from photos or things like that. So I just sort of naturally was always making things up. And that's, for me, that's the funnest aspect of painting. A lot of my studio paintings are completely made up.
Cool.
The one above that, the sunset, was complete invention. That place doesn't exist.
Oh.
And a lot of them are combinations of things that are made up and things that I've seen. And I incorporate my plein air sketches into them. And sometimes it's kind of almost just an enlargement of a plein air sketch. If I do a sketch on location, I really like it. I think it's pretty successful. I'll say, well, I might as well make a bigger version of this. And so that's some of my paintings. Some of my paintings are maybe combining a couple different sketches. And a lot of them are just complete inventions made up, which, as I said, is kind of the funnest or the most enjoyable way to work for me.
Okay. And then the one that we're looking at now is, I think, one of the Intercoastal Waterway. It has the, it'll be the one underneath Born to Run there. It's always amazing to me, and I'm going to, it's something that I'm going to have to start playing with. And it sounds so stupid to say, but I can see through your water. So,
yeah.
And it's like, yeah.
I can see right through you.
Yeah. And that's what I always tell my students. It's like, you know, how do you paint water? Well, you know, you can see through water. So kind of, it's interesting the way that you have this here. So were you on your boat when you were doing this, or were you down in?
I was on a boat, but not my boat.
Okay.
I was in Florida, and I rented one of those pontoon boats with a friend of mine, Bill Davis, who's a wonderful landscape painter also.
Okay.
He and his wife Judy came down, spent several days with us, and Bill and I went out painting several days, and we rented a pontoon boat once, and we did some paintings from the pontoon boat. And one of the things I love about water, it's such an elusive thing to paint, because mm-hmm. it has all these contradictory qualities. It's reflective, but it's also transparent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's heavy, it has weight and mass, but it's also, you know, obviously really malleable. You can splash around and push it around. It can be deep and it can be shallow. It can be perfectly still or it can be really rough. It has just all these different qualities. It's really fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the most intriguing, I think, is the sort of the tension between the reflective qualities and the transparent qualities of it. And this painting exploits the both of them. It goes from the reflective qualities in the distance, and as you look, the water comes closer to you, and you're looking more down into it, becomes more transparent. So I was really intrigued with that little phenomenon.
Yeah.
And that one has a lot of texture in the sand. I don't know if you can see it in the slide, but I used glass beads, which is a emulsion you can get it's an acrylic emulsion. I used that for the underpainting. And then I overpainted it with oil paint. But the glass beads look, they kind of give the impression of sand mm-hmm. on the sand part. And then if you look at the water, there's sort of a horizontal striated texture to it,
mm-hmm.
which replicates the little ripples. And the sky is painted quite smoothly. So mm-hmm. it says, I was saying earlier that, you know, I have these different elements and they're all painted differently because, you know, they're so different in the physicality that not only do I think they should look different, but their texture should be different too. They should be different, you know, their tactile quality should be different.
Right. And then this is part of your, you're talking about on Facebook, doing kind of an intercoastal waterways project, right?
Yes. And I guess I'm into projects lately because I've got one that's called the Boston Harbor Islands Project. And that's exploring, there's 32 islands in Boston Harbor. And I grew up along the shore of Boston Harbor. When I was a kid, we'd spend all summer long out in the islands exploring and hiking and swimming and camping and all that kind of stuff. And then I moved away, but I always sort of, would go back every now and then do some paintings out at the islands. And a couple of years ago, I thought, I'm going to make a little project of this because it's so fascinating to me. They're all different, the islands. Some have rocky beaches, some have sandy beaches. Some have big sort of rocky cliffs. Others have marshes and gravel beaches, and some of them are fairly cleared and some of them are all overgrown. A lot of them have forts and fortifications and buildings mm-hmm. from the 19th and 20th centuries. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of things that float up on the islands. There's driftwood all over the place and buoys and lobster traps and old car engines and bleach bottles and everything you can imagine has been washed up along the rack line. So it's really a fascinating place to paint. And I've been going out there for the last couple of years and doing a lot of plein air sketches on the islands and then bringing them home and making larger paintings, studio paintings out of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also intrigued with the waterways in Florida. Years ago, I was a yacht captain and I spent a lot of time on the East Coast and the West Coast of Florida. And I just realized that, you know, this is so fascinating too, this area, that maybe we'll make a little project out of this. So I'm calling it the Florida Waterways Project, and I'm going to concentrate on the shoreline right along the intercoastal and, you know, the adjacent waterways of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be going to Palm Beach in February. So I'm going to do a lot of paintings on the East Coast then, and then I'm going to Naples in April. So I'll do a lot of paintings of the West Coast then.
Cool.
And it'll be a multi-year project. It'll be an ongoing thing, just like the Boston Harbor Islands project is.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because you said that you don't know when it'll end. It's kind of like, I'll know it when I get there. And I love that. I thought that was so cool. So.
Well, I don't want to put any type of goal on it or thing right now because I don't know where it's going to end or where it's going to lead me. I'd like to just sort of be open to what comes along.
Yeah.
Just like the Boston Harbor Island Project, it's the same thing that these things that I'm really interested in, and they're places I find really fascinating, and I don't want to be constrained, like say, well, this is my goal and this is what I have to do. I want to sort of go where I'm sort of led by the subject matter
Okay.
and be open to, whatever interpretation I decide to make of it.
So, we're looking at the one down below that now, Joe, on the screen. But can you just
Okay, I can't see them below the
Okay.
Florida one.
Okay,
Is
so
there a way that you can scroll them?
hold on a second. Let me see if I can back out of here and see if I have a maybe I'm sharing the
Okay, yeah, I get it now.
Okay. This is the one that I'll do it from
So
here.
the
Yeah, this is
the one is a
the
big, yeah.
Can you see that one now? Okay. All right. So I guess, I'm looking at this, I'm hearing you talk. We talked about I know I can't possibly nail you down on every particular tool that you use, but how do you start your paintings? And I don't mean, well, I go out and I do this studio, I do this study, and then I go back to my studio and do this. I mean, I really physically, what's like the thing that you do? Because like I usually start with a value study, and then I build upon that with color and all that. So, and I know that you don't do that. I'm like pretty sure you don't do that.
No, actually, I do.
Oh, do you? Okay.
Not a study, well, not a value study, like in a separate work, but the first step that I would do is a black and white using acrylic gesso underpainting. So I have my composition locked in because the black and white is just basically a value study,
Right.
and that determines your composition. And I use gesso because it's a good base to put the oil painting on top of it. So it's a just a black and white value study with the underpainting, and I'll spend considerable time looking at it and making adjustments because it's easy to do it when you're just dealing with black and white gesso. And also, where it's just black and white, I'm not worried about matching colors. So if I want to change something, it's easy for me to just make the change and say, does that look better or not? And if it doesn't, I can change it back or change it again. So it doesn't, sometimes if you've got the color, oh, I get all the color mixed up and it's just right and I don't want to have to go back. And so subconsciously, you're a little bit resistant to change. But if I don't have a lot of time invested and it's easy for me to make a change, then I'll tend to make changes. And the changes I make usually are a really big improvement over what I had previously.
Okay,
So the
so
first thing I will do is this black and white or value shades of gray too, a value study
okay.
on the actual canvas or panel.
Okay.
And then if I'm using texture, I'll get some of the acrylic emulsion, or maybe just gesso, or it might be modeling paste, or they have all kinds of different additives that I've tried. And I'll put the appropriate texture in the different areas of the painting where I want the different textures. And that may take a little bit of manipulating and fooling around with the surface to get it to be just the way I want it. And once I've got that locked in, then I'll go in and start painting with the oil colors, working thinly and kind of loosely in the beginning stages, and then tightening it up as I move along. And there again, if I work sort of loosely without a lot of, worrying about rendering things at this stage, I'm more likely to make changes to improve the painting. And then as the painting, goes along, I'll use different techniques for putting on the paint, palette. And I use a lot of palette knife and squeegees, different kinds of brushes. I've got these brushes where I've given the ends of the brush a real ragged haircut kind of, and that works really well for painting like natural forms like bushes and trees and rocks and things like that. And then I'll use a lot of glazes also. Oftentimes putting on a glaze and then wiping it off to enhance the texture, and a lot of thick paint applied on top of that. So there's a lot of variety in the surface, and in the tactile quality of the paint. Because I want the paint to be interesting in its own right too. I don't want it just to describe, like in this painting, it's describing a rocky face with bright sunlight on it. But if you look at the painting in real life, there's a lot of texture on those rocks. So the painting, the paint itself is interesting too, rather than painting it smoothly and not having a lot of interest in the paint surface. I really want to exploit the qualities of paint. You know, it can be thick, it can be thin, it can be glazed, it can be textured. So there's a lot of manipulation, and I really enjoy it. When I was a kid, my dad was an artist. He did decorative painting mostly. But we'd use all these crazy tools to get different effects that he wanted to get. He did a lot. He did kind of a jack of all trades. He did anything with paint. He would accept a challenge if it was a paying job.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we used to do a lot of marbleizing, and we used seagull feathers. We'd get on the beach and collect the seagull feathers, and he would use it to create the veins in the marble if we were trying to make, say, a Carrara marble effect. And so I've adapted that, and I use it if I'm doing a like cirrus clouds in the sky. Mm-hmm. It works really well for replicating the look of cirrus clouds because they have that sort of marbly look to them.
Yeah.
So I use a lot of different tools, as I was saying before, in my paintings.
Right.
But it just makes the paint interesting. It sort of is a, you know, a sort of an abstract quality. If you just want to look at the paint surface, it makes it more interesting, I think.
And you're working wet into wet from start to end?
Or a little of everything. There again, some parts are wet into wet, some parts are dry. You know, if I'm putting on a glaze, the underpainting has to be really dry.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I want to like drag a brush across the dry surface so it just sort of picks up little drips and drabs of paint rather than painting the whole thing solid. So, you know, that'll be dry. So it's there again, there's a lot of variety in the way I apply the paint, sometimes wet and wet, sometimes dry. And I do a lot of, once the paint is on, I do a lot of scratching back into it and chipping and, you know, I keep manipulating the paint further until I get that effect that I want.
Okay, so is the process that you just described, is that more your studio process?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's different in the field because in the field I'm working wet and wet.
Right.
So there's not all that much opportunity to, you know, do a lot of different techniques in the field. But I paint fairly thickly in the field. I use this underpainting white that's made by Winsor & Newton, and it sets up really quickly so I can get a lot of detail. And I can also really quickly in the field because the paint gets so stiff that you can keep painting without having, you know, sometimes if your paint's too wet in the field, you just can't do anything with it. Everything's wet and sloppy. But the underpainting white gets really stiff quickly, so I can keep layering on top of it without getting that really sloppy, wet paint surface quality.
Right. But one of the things that you did recently, too, and I can actually still see the painting in my head, and you'll know which one it is. It's the one that I commented on in Facebook that I really loved. We don't have it, unfortunately. I probably should have went out and nabbed it, but it's the French countryside one that you did. And you said that was an older painting, and then you decided to go back and change some things in it. So I'm assuming that even though you sign a painting, it's not done.
No. As long as it's sitting in my studio, it's never done. I keep noodling them and tweaking them. And sometimes I send it out to a gallery and it doesn't sell. I bring it back and I get different ideas on what I can do to improve it.
Yeah, that
one.
So
yeah, I just keep working and working them to death.
Yeah, that one.
But when
gorgeous.
I see my old paintings, I always think of ways that I can improve them. I think that's good because it means I'm getting a little bit more discerning and I'm getting a little bit better as a painter.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess one of the things that I always run into with some of the students that I teach is they get tired of working on it naturally. So then they hurry up and quote unquote, finish it, sign it. And they think, oh, I'm done. And I sit there and I go, no, I'm like, no, you're done for now. You're going to come back to this one, you know? And it's like, no, I'm not, you know, and never fails. So about 3 or 4 months later, they come back and they go, I'm really not happy with this. I said, yeah, I know you weren't. So it's like, let's do this again. So you know, they'll start working on it. So I think that's great that, that you do that too. I think it's just kind of gives us a little more leeway to get out there and start questioning when our work is really finished and when it's not. So I wanted to state that as well. So this is a pretty little painting as well.
The other thing I want to say is that for me, it's really important when I think the painting is done to have it sit in the studio for a week or two, because I'll keep looking at it and I get these little ideas. Oh, I should change this. Oh, let me adjust that thing and make these little adjustments. And a lot of times there might be a shape that looks awkward that I didn't notice at first, but then every time I look at the painting, I see that shape and I have to change that shape. But at the end of a week or two, it's amazing how many minor adjustments I've made that add up to like a significant amount of repainting of the painting. And I think, boy, it's a good thing I kept that here without sending it out, because it's a much better painting now than it was then. So it's really important, I think, to look at your painting a lot and keep thinking of ways that you can make it better. And sometimes you walk in and something strikes you right off the bat and say, oh, I know what I can do with that painting. And then you make all these little improvements. And so the longer the painting sits in my studio, I mean, I guess in a way I would probably never finish a painting. If I had a painting sitting in my studio forever, I would keep noodling it and changing it. And I think one of the things is that I don't mind doing that, because it's telling me that I'm also getting, you know, better.
Right.
When I bring an old painting back and I'm kind of discouraged the way it looked, I think, geez, I thought it was better than that. I think it's because my eye is getting better and more discerning. And my skills are getting better. So then I'll take the painting and I'll repaint it and improve it and make it look a little bit better. And that's good, because I wouldn't want my old painting to come back and for me to say, boy, I was really good then. And why can't I do that now? I always want to say, oh, I know I'm better now, and I can, you know, make that into a better painting since I got it back.
Yeah. I mean, naturally, when you're at the beginning of your process, you're just learning. You're painting those miles of canvas. I ended up putting a knife through a number of those and just throwing them out. But those weren't rescue. You know, there was no improving particular ones. So, yeah, I mean, there's, you still, even at this stage, you're hopefully pushing yourself and making yourself think of maybe doing something a little bit different or taking something a little bit further. Yeah, so always should be thinking about doing that. So,
yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So we're getting close to chatting for about an hour, and I wanted you to talk a little bit about, you are going to be at the Plein Air Convention. Is that correct?
Yes, I'll be doing a pre-convention workshop, which will be, I think, a lot of fun. It's a day-long program, and I'll be doing... showing a lot of my techniques and demonstrating how I approach a painting, the different tools that I use. I'll show the sight size viewfinder and how I use that, and how it works, and different ways of creating texture. And I'll talk about composition, color, lighting, where, you know, light is really important for me. And I think it's important for most landscape painters. They'll spend a lot of time on how to create the effect of sunlight on different objects. And I've been painting landscapes outside since I was since I was a kid, really, but pretty seriously since I was about 19, I think, is when I got my first official outdoor painting kit. Wow. And so I've learned a lot over the years. It's like 40 years that I've been, 41 years I've been painting outside. So there's a lot I've picked up over the years that make the process go much more quickly with better results. And easier to, you know, drag all your stuff out there and get a half decent painting done.
Yeah.
So I'll be talking about that, you know, things I've done that make it much easier and more successful for the artist.
So, and that's a pre-convention workshop. So that's before
the
actual convention.
The day before the convention starts. Okay. We go from, I think it's like 9 to 6 at night. So it'll be a long day.
Okay.
And, I'll be on the stage demonstrating all these things, talking to folks, answering questions and such.
Okay. And then you'll be on stage actually at the convention demoing, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Then later in the week, I'll do a stage demo for, I think that's only an hour and a half. So it'll be kind of an abbreviated version of what I'm going to be talking about. I may I may probably do things differently because I don't want to give a repeat for the things that people that did the pre-convention saw.
Right.
So I'll do something different. I'm not sure exactly what I'll be doing for that yet. I've got a couple months to figure it out.
Right.
But it'll be some type of a demonstration, some aspect of planar painting and how I approach it.
Yeah. This one's gorgeous, by the way.
Thanks. This was a fun one to do. I painted the water. I didn't have the sunlight, dappled sunlight through the ripples of the water when I first did it. And I kept looking at the water and I thought, it looks a little bland. It needs something. I kind of wanted it to be simple because I wanted your eye to lead up into the top near the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
But then I thought, it just needs something. So I got this real wet, watery mixture of paint. And I painted these sort of squiggles all along the surface there in the foreground. And then I got my thumb and got a paper towel and wiped off these little oval shapes sort of all through it to give the effect of those ripples creating the sun dappling on the seafloor. So it was kind of fun. I didn't know if it would work out. It was just kind of one of those experiments. Well, let me try this. Oh, that looked kind of cool. And it actually creates the effect that I was trying to create, which I was kind of surprised that it worked.
Yeah, so like, do you jump up and do a high five?
Yeah.
Woohoo, yeah.
I was like, oh, thank God it worked.
So is this actually a plein air study then? Or did you go back to the studio?
No, this is the studio painting. I did this plein air study for this the same time as I did that previous Florida painting.
Oh, okay.
They're looking different directions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you certainly.
This one I was actually sitting in the boat.
Oh, cool.
Painting it. The other one I think we had the boat right on the shore. I was on the shore in the other one.
Yeah.
But this one I was on the boat.
Yeah. I mean, you certainly, I could definitely say, yeah, this is Florida. Because I've been there. So yeah, it's really, really nice. So I like that one.
Yeah. I just love how the land and the water sort of interact and the sand is so malleable that, the currents just push it all around and you get these beautiful shapes and S curves and such. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the nice accent of the dark green mangrove trees mm-hmm. coming down into the water.
Yeah.
And I thought it had a little fun with the ship in the background spewing out its exhaust out the smokestack.
Yeah, that's cool. And there's this real strong simplicity to this that is just makes it gorgeous, I think. So.
Yes, I wanted it to be really simple.
Yeah.
And I wanted your eye to sort of float over the foreground and then settle off in the horizon
mm-hmm.
in the background. And there again, I mean, this doesn't really follow any of the rules of composition.
Right.
You couldn't find this composition in Payne's book, I don't think, but it seemed like, a pleasing arrangement of shapes. It seems to work for me.
Yeah.
Compositionally.
Yep. Yep. Great. It's gorgeous. So do you have any workshops coming up at your, at outside of the plein air convention, or do you have any of them?
Yes. I've got two in Florida and Sarasota in April. I think they're both sold out. It's with the Light Chasers group.
Oh, okay.
So people could contact them and see if there's a spot, but I think they're both sold out. And then the convention in April in San Francisco, and then in May, the Plein Air Painters of America, which I'm a member of, we're having a workshop in Scottsdale, Arizona. It'll be a 5-day. And it's kind of unique because you'll study with, the first day will be presentations by, I think there's six of us artists going. And then the next 4 days, you'll study 2 days with one instructor and then 2 days with another instructor. So you get a little taste of everything, which will be kind of fun, I think, and enjoyable.
Yeah.
So that's in Scottsdale, Arizona, at the Scottsdale Artist School. If you go on their website, you can find information about that.
Yeah.
And that's in May. And then next September, I'll be doing one here at my house on Cape Cod. I haven't got that up in the calendar yet. We're not sure exactly when that'll be happening.
Okay.
But that's going to run down for the year coming up.
Cool. And I saw on Facebook, too, that you're part of a rowing society. Is this out in Nantucket where you live, or, well, you don't live in Nantucket, but
I live in Cape Cod.
Cape Cod. Yeah.
It's a very unofficial I have this house on Squeteague Harbor on Cape Cod. It's a really beautiful little harbor.
Okay.
And I've always been rowing and such. I love rowing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have this rowing dory, and my brother has a rowing dory, and my son Max has a rowing dory. And I have a friend, Paul, who builds boats, and he's built a couple of different types of rowboats. And so we thought, let's start a little rowing club. So we've been rowing. We've got other guys come along every now and then. We just started it this winter.
Okay.
But it gets us out of the house on a Sunday afternoon. We row for a couple of hours, and then we come back to my house. We have chowder here and talk about boats. But it's fun. But it's like all the other things I do. You know, I'm a recreational runner and skiing and hiking and such. It all kind of leads back to painting, because when I'm out rowing, I'm looking at all these different subjects and scenarios and ways that I can interpret nature. And there's a couple of paintings I just did on Facebook of a sailboat coming down this canal with a sort of a massive trees on the right hand side, and two different sun effects, but they're what I saw when I was out rowing. One is a sort of an afternoon sunset, and the other is more of a midday with some dappled sunlight. But, you know, those ideas I got when I was rowing down in that, through that canal that leads out to Buzzards Bay. So the rowing is, you know, kind of extension of my art career too, because I'm sort of in the element that I'm portraying.
Yeah.
And I get these wonderful ideas when I'm out there. And when you exercise, you get that endorphin high. And everything's wonderful, and you see compositions and paintings everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes a little bit of that sort of holds over, and, you know, I retain that a little bit. I say, oh, I know what I can do with this, you know, painting. I'll make this wonderful composition. And then halfway through the painting, I'm struggling, saying, oh, I can't quit now. I have too much invested, but this isn't coming out very well. All the paintings start the same way, but I start off, this is going to be the best painting I ever did. And then when I'm about two-thirds of the way through, it's falling apart. I'm saying, oh, my God, this is terrible. But I have to finish it. I have too much time invested. And then I struggle through. And at the end, I say, oh, it's pretty good, but I know I can do better next time. And I think that's what keeps artists going, is I always say, it's like, I don't play golf, but I think when you play golf, you hit the ball and you say, ooh, that's pretty good, but I know the next time will be better. And I think it's the same thing with painting. You know, I think artists, oh, that's pretty good, but I know I can do better next time. So you go out and you do your next painting, keep trying to make them better. And, you know, generally they are. There's a progression and improvement, just like in golf.
Yep. Yeah, I go out and play golf, and I walk down the fairway going, well, that's a really interesting shape. What's what color would I paint that? What value is that? Where, you know? So that's when I play golf. That's what I'm typically doing. And my husband's walking down there going,
what club?
What club are you going to use? Which, you know, he's thinking all golf. I'm sitting there, oh, look at that color of the sky. It's how would I mix that color? You know, so it keeps my mind off of golf. Yeah. So I probably play better golf that way, but yeah. So, and then, I guess anything else you want to say? Any announcements you want to make? I think we kind of like hit them all, but give you an opportunity here before we close up.
I think it was a great conversation.
Yeah.
You asked some wonderful questions. I enjoyed. I love talking about art. So it's like, especially with, you know, sometimes I talk about art to people who don't really know a lot about it, and after a while, I think their eyes sort of glaze over. So it's nice talking to folks who sort of run the same page as me.
Yeah, well, we hadn't talked in a while, so it was good to hear your voice again. So,
yeah, well, great to hear your voice too, Linda. Well, hopefully, we'll see each other in the not too distant future.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm going to be out at track, but I don't think you're going to actually be out on the West Coast. I think at the end of April, I'm going to be out at the beginning of April. So I'm actually presenting a paper at track. So it'll be kind of interesting.
Oh, great.
Yeah. That's a first for me. So.
Excellent.
Yeah. So
what's the topic of your paper?
It's the topic of the whole conference is imagination. And paper that I'm going to be presenting is Imagination versus Creativity. I call a cognizant balance with a question mark at the end.
Yeah.
You know, can you do one without the other? What, it, you know, that kind of creativity is kind of the process of bringing our imagination into the physical state, that kind of conversation. I've got a pretty good idea where where I want the paper to go. Certainly don't want to answer the question because I think just some of the different art references that I'm going to be using in it, some people are wonderful working more in their imaginary side and other people need more process. So I don't think there's a correct answer for anybody. But yeah, so it's just kind of exploring that a little bit. So it'll be interesting.
Cool. Yeah, that sounds interesting.
So thank you, Joe, so much for spending time with us and sharing some of your wonderful artwork with us. It's like I said, it's always a treasure to see. And I always, I get the images and I sit there and look and go, oh, man, I really like to see this one in person. So it's someday soon, maybe if I ever make it up to Cape Cod, I'll stop in and see you. So,
Okay, that sounds great. And thank you for asking me to join you in the conversation.
always,
It was
huh?
wonderful. And thank you, all you listeners out there, for listening to us for this past hour or so.
Yeah, it's great to have everyone aboard and hope that you will all refer your friends to listening too if you've got a lot of good information out of this because I think Joe shares a lot of great information every time we talk to him. So I appreciate it, Joe. Thank you so much. And thanks everyone for tuning in and we'll catch you next time.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.